Afternoon, everybody. This is the State Department's of Veterans Budget Division, and it's February 7th, 2013, and it's about 3:12. Welcome, everybody. We have a quorum. Today, members, we have five budget reviews to be presented to this committee. In your package, you have the agenda. It's a spreadsheet with all the governor's change items, spreadsheets specific to the five jurisdictions, and handouts for the respective testifiers. You also have your budget books in front of you. I suppose you can take them if you want to. Just make sure you bring them back. Otherwise, you know, we'll bring them back every day for you. Okay. And with the exception of the Historical Society, we're going to proceed alphabetically. So there is one correction on the agenda. Chief Judge Ray Krause will be testifying for the Office of Administrative Hearings. With that, we're going to start with Chief Judge Raymond Krause, and we're going to ask him to come up, state his name, and proceed. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ray Krause, and I am the Chief Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear this afternoon. I know there's a full agenda, so what I would like to do, if it meets with the approval of the committee, is just do a brief overview of the Office of Administrative Hearings, what we do, and the budgets, how we're funded for each of the three divisions, and then address the very few changes that there are in our budget according to the governor's recommendation.
That sounds good, Judge. Thank you.
The Office of Administrative Hearings is an executive branch court. We provide due process hearings to the citizens of Minnesota. Most of the cases are of citizens appealing a decision made by a state agency. We also provide hearing services to cities, townships, and counties on a contract basis. In addition to hearings, the Office of Administrative Hearings is responsible for review of the legality of most proposed rulemaking by state agencies. There are, as I mentioned, three divisions within the Office of Administrative Hearings: the Workers' Compensation Division, the Administrative Law Division, and the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Division. The first, Workers' Compensation, is the largest division. We have 23 full-time judges, including an assistant chief administrative law judge, and we have currently two vacancies that are unfilled. This division is funded completely through an appropriation from the Special Compensation Fund, and there are no general funds used to support this division of the OAH. In addition, there is no change in the budget. We have the same budget as we've had for a number of years in that division, and there's no change in the governor's recommendation. The second division is the Administrative Law Division. The Administrative Law Division provides the due process hearings for everything other than workers' comp. So it's everything from utilities hearings for the Public Utilities Commission to hearings for the DNR, Department of Education, any of the state agencies that utilize our hearing services.
Judge, give us an example of what might be a hearing that you might do for the DNR.
For the DNR, I'll give you an example of one I had not too long ago. I'll give you one that we're doing a lot of right now. The DNR is being super vigilant for invasive species being carried on boats, and they've been issuing a lot of tickets for people who don't remove their boat plug when they transport the boat from lake to lake. And being hyper-vigilant, there's been a lot of appeals of those fines. And we've had quite a few of those cases this year where a citizen would say, come to us and appeal that fine for transporting their boat, allegedly with the boat plug in it, contrary to the Invasive Species Act.
Okay.
So that's the kind
example.
Of thing.
Yeah.
If someone's put up a wall around their property on a lake to prevent erosion, and that's not met with DNR requirements, that DNR would require them perhaps to pull out that wall, and they would appeal that to us. Those kinds of things would be what we would hear.
Okay, good. Thank you. Go ahead. That'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, we have seven full-time judges in the Administrative Law Division, including one assistant administrative law judge. We have five contract judges, which we use for overflow and for conflicts, and I carry a caseload in both divisions as well. The Administrative Law Division is funded by billing the party that requests us to hold the hearing. Usually that's the state agency, the DNR, the PUC, or whoever is requiring the hearing. We would bill that agency. We bill at $165 per hour, which is significantly less than the state average for attorneys, which is currently statewide $264 per hour. And this rate that we charge is set by MMB, and it's set to be a break-even so that we don't make money, but we don't lose money either. And that's been pretty much the case for the last 10 years at least. We have only had to raise the rate once, and that was to account for a very large increase in PUC cases that were coming. There are generally no general funds used in the Ad Law Division, with two exceptions. The first is data practices cases. Just in 2010, the legislature passed a bill that gave us the authority to hear fast-track data processing, data practice cases. People can still go to the Department of Administration through iPad or to district court if they want to get data released by some level of government. But in cases where they want to do this in a very expedient way, there's a fast track, and that's where we come in. We hold those fast track hearings and turn those around in a very short period of time. The way those are funded, according to the bill that passed in 2010, is a person requesting the hearing to get the data would put up a $1,000 filing fee, and we would bill against that. If the unit of government prevails, we would bill against that $1,000 fee up to the amount of our cost, and if there's money left over, it would go back to the person who put up the filing fee. If there's no money left and the cost to us is more than $1,000, we are without recourse. And that has led to a shortfall because when the legislature passed this, there was really no experience on how much these cases would cost to process. And we all made a guess at about $1,000, but most of the cases that we've gotten in the couple of years that we've been doing this now are substantially more than $1,000. And because we're prohibited by law from shifting costs from one case type to another, we can't spread that loss over other kinds of cases, which means we've had a shortfall for the last 2 years. That's one of the governor's recommendations for a change. He has recommended a $40,000 one-time appropriation to cover that shortfall for the last 2 years, at least partially. He's recommending a $36,000 appropriation. The loss was about $40,000. But we are working now with the people who wanted this legislation in the first place, primarily the media, to find a better funding mechanism. We think we have some good ideas that we're working on, and hopefully we can get that going this year yet and avoid any of these shortfalls going forward. But that is one of the recommendations for change in the governor's proposal. The second exception is political campaign violation cases. They are funded through an appropriation from the Political Campaign Fund, and we bill against that appropriation. as needed. It's a $130,000 biennial appropriation, and it's worked extremely well since 2004, I think it was, when this was passed. We've never reached that ceiling. This year, we've had a tremendous increase in this case type over previous years. I'm not sure what to attribute that to, but our numbers went to, we had 54 of these cases in 2012 and only five last year, and only 37 the year before that. So it's been a significant increase.
Judge, you think that that might be a reflection of the amount of money spent, or?
That's hard to say. I think we're seeing, although that when we started doing these cases, we put all the results on our website, and we saw a decrease at first of the cases because people could look on our website and say, oh, they've already adjudicated that. I don't need to do this over again. I know I won or I know I lost, and not file the complaint. So we saw a decrease. The ones that we're seeing now are, I'd hate to characterize all of them this way, but many of them are just, I hate to use this word, but mean-spirited. They're not terribly substantive in the sense that there are real violations. There are many just people who are very mad and want to file a complaint, and it does take some time to, the way the process was laid out in the legislation, to go through and give them their preliminary hearing and that sort of thing. So they do cost money, but many of them don't end up being cases where there's actually a violation found and some sort of penalty. We ended up about $60,000 over our budget because of this, and there is no governor's recommendation to alleviate that shortfall, unlike the data practices where the governor did put in a recommendation to alleviate the shortfall. One thing I'd like to note for this committee, because it does affect the funding of this particular case type, is that when the legislation was originally passed, the $130,000 appropriation from the campaign fund was to deal only with statewide races. All local races, we were to bill the local unit of government on our regular hourly basis. And from our perspective, that worked fine. As you might expect, the counties, townships, and cities weren't too happy about that. And 4 years ago, they got the legislature to have to make a change so that all cases are billed out of that same $130,000, whether they're statewide or local. And we don't bill the local units of government now. Two things about that. One is that's partly why we're over budget, because it was never meant to, the 130 was never meant to account for all kinds of cases, only statewide. And number two, that is a temporary fix, and we go back this June to billing the cities, counties, and townships for local races. Now, that the effect of that would be that in the future we wouldn't have the overages because we're able to bill. Most of the cases are local, and we'll be able to bill those, and the $130,000 of the campaign fund will be ample for the statewide races. But I should warn you that the cities, counties, and townships were very vocal about not wanting to be billed for that, and you may hear from them if there isn't some extension of this or made permanent. I think 2 years ago, Senator Rest, if I remember correctly, you were considering, when you were chair of the Government Operations Committee, making this permanent or doing some other kind of fix for that particular problem. But I wanted to make the committee aware that that is something that's going to expire and will affect how we account for these things going forward. Our final...
Excuse me, Judge.
Yes, sir.
Senator Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many cases, like local cases, do you get, and what... do you have like an average, how much that cost on average, and how many?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as I said, we had this year 54 cases in 2012, and I'd say probably 50 of those 54 were local. We have very few statewide cases, maybe five or six, but not much more than that, that were statewide. The cases, the cost of each case varies widely. For example, a case that comes in and it's clearly not something we have jurisdiction over, or it's something that's the law really doesn't prohibit, and it's pretty obvious on its face, we dismiss those at a very early stage with only one judge, and they may cost $100 or something of that nature because it's not much time spent. There are cases that have gone all the way up to the Minnesota Supreme Court that are very complex issues of interpretation of the campaign laws as to what an incumbent means, for example, which was not defined, and whether one uses that in their advertising, whether you once were the incumbent, but you're not now, but you're saying you once were the incumbent, and things like the reelect so-and-so, even though there's been a gap between the first election and the second. Those kind of questions eat up a lot of judicial time to try to figure out, and those cases can run $3,000 roughly on average for those bigger cases. The third division of the Office of Administrative Hearings is the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Unit, and this group manages the process of annexations, detachments, as well as creation and dissolutions of cities. We have two excellent staff in this division, and one assistant chief ALJ, one of my two, acts as the director of this unit as well. The Municipal Boundary Adjustments Unit is funded through an appropriation from the general fund, and it's $254,000 per year for that unit. So that's the only unit that's entirely funded out of general funds, and it's a relatively small group. I would also note, it may be in your papers, that the governor has recommended an increase to the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Group of $75,000 for fiscal 14 and $50,000 for fiscal 15 and thereafter. That is a result of a request by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that the governor, I gather, has approved to shift the management of annexations, dissolutions, creations, and detachments of sanitary districts from being managed by the PCA to us. The PCA felt we could do it faster, better, cheaper, and so they're asking to shift that responsibility to us. It's very, very similar to what the municipal boundary adjustments do for annexations and of cities and townships. So that was the idea for that increase. It's not our request, but it is affecting our budget. So I thought I'd raise that. That's our division, our office in a snapshot. I know that's very brief. If you have questions, I'd be happy to expand on anything in here, but I wanted to keep it as brief as I can for your full schedule.
We appreciate that, Judge Krause. Any questions?
Yeah, curious, Mr. Cruz, about that shifting of that $75,000 to the Boundaries Division. Is there a corresponding cut somewhere else then?
Mr. Chair,
department that was doing.
Senator Metzen, yes, that is a shift of money from I don't know what fund. Again, this is not our proposal, so I don't know what fund it's from, but it's a PCA-controlled fund to the MBA unit. So it's a decrease somewhere else. I'm not sure where.
Judge Cross and Senator Metzen, I think that's what why it isn't in our sheet here is because it will be coming. It will be coming from the PCA.
Okay, yes, that's my understanding.
Mr. Chairman, sometimes we make that shift, and there's not a corresponding cut somewhere else.
We'll keep our eyes on this one. Yeah, we'll keep our eyes on it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, other questions for Judge Krause? If not, thank you very much, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Thank you. Next, we have overview of the governor's recommendation for the Cosmetologist Examiner's Board.
Oh, yeah.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Identify yourself go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gina Stouse-Fast, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetology. And I've been with the board since 2006, and I thank you for the opportunity today to give a brief overview of the Board of Cosmetology, its functions, and the governor's recommendations. The BCE statutory authority resides in Minnesota Chapter 155A, and the mission is to protect the health and safety of the citizens and visitors of the state by licensing the practice of cosmetology. The core mission is to constantly strive to serve and care for our licensees, applicants, and the public by being committed to public protection, superior service, excellence, continuous improvement. And the board is dedicated to public protection while encouraging industry development. The board was founded in 1927. Currently, it has four members. Three of them are licensed in the field of cosmetology, and one is a public member who happens to be an Anoka County attorney. They're appointed to four-year terms by the governor. The board hosts about 5 to 6 public meetings a year. And in addition to the full board, we have a complaint committee panel that reviews and decides complaints that are received by the board. And we meet about 5 to 6 times a year. And to kind of expand on what the judge was saying, a complaint that would come through our board may eventually get to their office. The board employs 13.8 employees, and our office is broken up into four divisions that I will be discussing in brief. It's a licensing division, a compliance division, an inspection division, and our administrative division. Our licensing division is responsible for verifying the credentials to ensure that each applicant has met the requisite education and competence to practice cosmetology or to operate a salon or a school. The division is responsible to manage and service over 42,000 licensees, as well as we issue roughly 3,500 new licenses a year, and we renew roughly 12,000 a year. We have over 14 different license types. Of the 42,000, 35,000 are personal licenses, roughly 5,000 are salons throughout the state, and we have roughly 45 schools. Licenses are issued on a 3-year period, and for the roughly 42,000 licensees that we have roughly one staff person for 3,144 licensees. Our next area, which is our compliance division, it's responsible to investigate complaints that are either filed by the board or by the public and take actions against cosmetologists, salons, or schools that violate laws and rules the board is empowered to enforce. We roughly investigate and process 125 complaints per year, and these can involve anything from licensing infractions, meaning someone didn't renew or they've been expired for 5 years, they don't have a license at all, or more importantly, when we find severe sanitation violations within a salon. Our inspection division is responsible to inspect all licensed salons and schools in the state to ensure public safety is met by demonstrating sanitation and disinfecting practices as well as general practice standards. Our inspection process is an opportunity as well to ensure all practitioners are licensed and to educate them about the minimum standards of sanitation practices. Where are the salons? Roughly 43% of the salons are in the metro area, with the rest out of state. We inspect roughly 3,000 salons per year, which is roughly 20 a week, and we have 3 inspectors in the state. And our last division, which is our administrative division, is essentially responsible to hold the public board meetings, gather all the information, and to oversee all 3 divisions so they work together in harmony and collaborate. A lot of times we're asked, like, why are we here? Why is the Board of Cosmetology, why do people need a license? And I wanted to provide some information on that today. And the most common sanitation or injuries that result is when porous items are being reused. And this is very, unfortunately, very common. Things such as nail files, nail bits, buffers, or toe dividers. And if you're familiar with Paula Abdul or Serena Williams, both of them have been in the national news. It was a couple years ago, but Paula Abdul almost had to have her finger amputated because of an infection she received while going to a salon. It wasn't adjudicated, so it wasn't proven 100%. Serena Williams and tennis players as well have had issues with getting pedicures and then having an infection as a result of a pedicure and not being able to play their sports. So the reuse of items is definitely a big concern. A lot of people get waxing done on different surfaces, different areas of their body, commonly on your eyebrows. And often waxing pots are not cleaned properly, or sometimes even wax is reused from one person to the other, which is just awfully disgusting. I was going to bring pictures, but I thought we'll wait till next time. I can bring them, though. The next one, because pedicures are so popular, unsanitary foot basins that people are putting in, most of the pedicure, they call them thrones, they have a little tub at the bottom that you put your feet in. A lot of times those aren't cleaned properly. They're using Windex. They're not using hospital-grade disinfectants. They're not cleaning the proper pipes, and so those just result in bacteria growth. Other things such as illegal equipment, such as Credo blades. The best example I can give you is think of a cheese grater that you might grade some cheese. Well, they're grading your feet with that. That is unfortunately without of the scope of cosmetology, and that's surgically removing the skin from your feet, and you can't do that unless you're appropriately trained. Other injuries that can happen: your eyes can be damaged by hair chemicals. You can get face injuries from different facials, warts, athlete foots, burned scalps. And the biggest kind of hot topic is MRSA. I am not going to attempt to say what that medical word is. It's very long. But really what it is, it's a staph infection that can, if your body doesn't respond to the antibiotics, you can die within hours. And so that is a common, I don't want to say common, but that is one area that the National Association is really hitting on. And the last thing that's kind of a little odd that is also on our radar is human trafficking. We don't regulate it, but we do collaborate with the FBI, and other states do this as well when we see a potential of human trafficking. And how we would find this is if we're in a salon and you find a full, like, bed, like living quarters at the back of a salon. That's kind of the FBI's biggest tip, that human trafficking may be going on in within the salon. So that's part of why we're here.
Ms. Stas-Fast,
yep.
Do you have anything to do with, for instance, laser removal or anything like that?
Well, That's a very good question, Senator. That is not within the scope of practice for a cosmetologist. It's not taught in our curriculum. However, the board is working on determining what is actually taught in the basic curriculum for a licensee who can perform it, as well as looking at creating an advanced curriculum. I think there's an opportunity for the Board of Cosmetology, the Nursing Board, and the Medical Board to collaborate to figure out where some of these gray lines are being drawn. I would have to say that there are likely estheticians performing lasers, but it's delegated by someone else.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
It does. Okay. Thank you for that answer. And then, in terms of the governor's budget and
yes.
your budget, is there any changes that you want to tell us about?
Mr. Chairman, the governor's budget, there are no changes. So my next slide was really that our revenue is roughly at $1.8 million. We've been appropriated $1.046 in the last biennium, and the governor has recommended the same. We are a general-funded agency, but we 45% of our revenues stay in the general fund. So the governor has not recommended any changes to our budget.
Okay.
So you're not getting clipped.
Well.
All right, that's enough. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metz and I have gone. We've been together for a long time, haven't we?
I know we have.
Yes.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Are there two ladies still bothering you every week or? Well, that'll be a sidebar conversation.
Oh, okay.
Remember that's, yeah, okay.
Yes.
I'll remind you out in the hallway.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. Question. Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Stouse, did you say there were like 3,000 licenses, salons in the state or more?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there's roughly 5,000 salons in the state.
And does that include like all of the there was this kind of discussion between the barbers and the cosmetologists and where do they cross or
Ms. Dust Fast.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a separate independent board of barbers, and the state does not have they have their separate barbershop license, and we have cosmetology, which is hair, skin, and nails. You also can have a manicuring-only salon, which is nails only, and you can have an esthetician, which is skin only. So if you so happened, if you happened to open a salon where you wanted to employ a barber as well as a cosmetologist, you would have two separate licenses. You would be regulated by the Board of Barbers and by the Board of Cosmetology independently. And so there's no transfer of you can't be a cosmetologist and like automatically go apply for a barber license or vice versa. You have to complete the schooling independently. And I can only say I know this because of the history of the two agencies. So, but there isn't a reciprocity between the two. And I think it's probably best that way.
Thank you.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Next, we have the Gambling Control Board. Mr. Barrett, Executive Director. How are you, Mr. Barrett?
I am well. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is...
Identify yourself and... go ahead. Thank you.
Yep. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the director of the Gambling Control Board. I did provide a couple of handouts. One is a copy of our latest annual report. I won't go through that in any detail, but that gives a kind of a picture of the charitable gaming industry for the fiscal year ending June 30th. Get a flavor for how the industry has been operating, where they spend their money, and some of the programs. What I thought I would do is briefly go through what I would call the manual PowerPoint presentation. Didn't bring the electronics. But just a brief overview of who the Gambling Control Board is and what we do. Our mission is twofold. Obviously, it's to maintain the integrity of the industry that we're monitoring, the charitable gaming industry and the products that are provided, but also to keep an eye on the nonprofits that are involved in the charitable gambling to make sure that the proceeds that they gather from charitable gaming operations are used for charitable purposes. We're called the Gambling Control Board, but a lot of folks will call us with questions related to the lottery or maybe the racing commission, but our five forms of charitable gaming are pull tabs, tip boards, which is a smaller paper version of the pull tab, paddle wheels, it's not the riverboat, but it's the Wheel of Fortune type activity, obviously bingo, and then raffles. But of those five categories, pull tabs by far is the biggest entity attributed to roughly 92% of all sales for charitable gaming. What we're not? We're not the state lottery. You'll hear about those folks next. Tribal, certainly a lot of impact on what's going on in the internet, sports wagering, and then Prairie Mutual. While we don't have any oversight of those entities, we're very much in contact when we see some issues developing in the gaming industry. Work very close with the lottery. In fact, I compliment them because we got some of our surplus computer equipment from the lottery. Who is the board? We have seven members. There are five are appointed by the governor, one is appointed by the attorney general, and then one is appointed by the commissioner of public safety. I have a great staff of 30 people, but our divisions are split between licensing. So if somebody wants to get into the charitable gaming industry, they got to first prove that they're a registered nonprofit. Our compliance section that does the audits, as well as some of the site visits. And then we have an investigative unit where we find problems that are taking place in the conduct of gambling, and then our small administrative staff to handle the administrative duties. How do we regulate? Obviously, it's the first point in terms of the licensing, whoever wants to be involved in the activity. And that includes the nonprofit organizations, the locations where they might conduct bingo, the manufacturers that produce the product, the distributors that bring the product to the charities, and then the gambling managers. If a charity wants to be involved in gambling, they have to designate one of their members to become the gambling manager. And that's where we put a lot of emphasis on the training and education, because they'll be required to do the reporting, monitoring, making sure that the operation runs smooth. To do that, we supplement not just the initial training for the gambling managers, but we do approximately 35, 40 continuing education classes around the state different times during the year to keep the gambling managers informed on the latest changes, maybe what's happened in law, what's happening in the new format. We also approve and test games. Before any of the games hit the street, they're going through our review. In terms of activity, on average, we're approximately 375, close to 400 new paper pull tab games every month. And so there's a tremendous amount of volume. But I know the industry wants the latest, greatest symbols, names, and they're always looking for that. But tremendous volume that goes through. But our regulatory audits and our site inspections, I think, are the key things that the charities welcome us to be there, to make sure that they are doing things according. Given the size of the organizations, the number of sites, I'd love to say we're out there every year, but it's roughly once every a little more than 2 years now. The bottom line is, unfortunately, if we don't get our attention with audits and site inspections, we do have the civil opportunity to impose fines or suspensions to obviously make sure that they're doing what's appropriate and, again, raising charitable funds for charitable causes.
Mr. Barrett, you... Tell us a little bit about the number of fines and suspensions and revocations. Is that fairly evident, or is that there's very few of them?
Mr. Chair, everything might be relative, but in a billion-dollar industry, our fines last year, I'm looking for it, was $31,100.
Wow.
Now, what we fine doesn't come to us and back for operation. It goes to the general fund, so we can't be accused of upping, but... Very happy. I know we had the administrative law judge here before. We have an opportunity, if we find an organization in trouble, to sit the organization down, find out if they can correct their ways. Great. It might not be painless. But we try to implement what's fair, a corrective measure, including a fine or suspension. If they don't agree with our position or the offer to for solution, they can take it to the administrative law judge. And in the last 5 years, we haven't had one case go to the administrative law judge, which is, I think, it's an example of we'll give the charity every opportunity to get back on the right path, but at the same time, we will take the enforcement if we find that there's problems.
Good.
The industry we regulate, approximately 2,800 gaming sites. Our primary locations are bars, restaurants. We license 1,200 charitable organizations, in other words, a little more than almost 2.5 sites per licensed organization, 1,200 gambling managers, 3,900, actually it's over that, 3,900 exempt and excluded permits. Those are the small civic church activity raffles that take place throughout the year. But the value of those 3,900 exempt activities last year was over $33 million. We have 10,000 paid gambling employees, 13 licensed distributors, 10 manufacturers, and currently two linked bingo game providers. Numbers, again, I think sometimes it surprises folks when they see that charitable gaming in Minnesota is over $1 billion. Minnesota ranks number one in the country in terms of activity, one of the smallest, I'll say, in terms of regulatory oversight budget-wise. But at the same time, after you pay out the prizes back to the player, roughly 82%, approximately $41 million is coming back to the state in the way of tax receipts. $43.5 million does get to that bottom line for the youth hockey, the fire relief, the veterans. And while our budget here reflects a $2.7 million, that was based on fiscal year 12, but with the activity, the new activity, which happy to talk about either today or later, but involving the electronic gaming, there was an increase in our budget activity in that respect.
Maybe you could say a few words about that anyway.
Okay.
It is something pretty
important.
So.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that opportunity. I would extend an invite to come back to the committee as well as
sure.
we we continue on. But I know we've read some of the media and the like, but let me take you back in time when the legislature passed the allowance for the electronic gaming. This is something the industry was looking for going back roughly 3 years. I know they're trying to compete with some of the other entities, but there's final consideration last year to move in that direction. With that said, the bill was signed on, I believe it was May 14th. But 3 days later, we had our first application from a vendor interested to bring in the electronic. And my point here is from the time the bill was signed to our establishment of the standards by which this product was going to be made available and put out for use, a little less than just under four months activity to go from bill signed to the first day of sales, which is, I think, a credit for working with the industry and the likes. State of Virginia passed a bill almost 3 years ago now. They've just launched their first sales with a similar format. We've been in contact with them. They've been in contact with us. But in terms of the rollout, we actually started a month sooner than we were expecting. And again, this is an indication working with the vendors, the testing labs that are knowledgeable of this kind of equipment, and getting the standards approved by the board, then working with the vendors. So we get up to the launch, but there's still a number of vendors that are now going through the pipeline, going through the background checks. We have two vendors currently approved to produce electronic game products for to be available for distribution through the distributors. We have three manufacturers that are pending license application. They're still going through the background checks. But at the same time, while they're going through that process, we are working with them on their product development. So in case, regardless of their license, we're trying to keep ahead because we know that the charities want more vendors to choose from, more product, and those things. But as you've seen, now that the games have started to roll out, the numbers aren't coming in as expected, as we were projecting. We're at approximately 140 sites as of last Friday. By this point in time, we thought we'd be upwards of 300 sites. A couple of things that are contributing to that. We're still confident that as these games roll out and become accepted, we expect to see those numbers obviously increase. Well, a couple of factors are contributing to what we're seeing, and the biggest thing I think I can label is distributor loyalty. The charities have always bought their paper products from this distributor. It's kind of like how many times anybody change insurance agents and the like. With the respect for those distributors that have always provided that service, not all of them have the opportunity to carry the electronics. There's a requirement that if they are going to do the electronics, they need to present a plan because it's a different animal compared to delivering the paper games. But now that we have nine of those vendors, they're starting to align with the anticipation of more manufacturers. The expectation is more distributors handling the product, the more word. But there are a number of charities that are taking a wait and see. This is something new. We don't want to get in just yet. Let's work the bugs out. I'm happy to say the bugs have been somewhat minimal. They really have.
So, Mr. Barry, you think it's kind of more of a snowball deal. It's going to be, at some point here, there's going to be kind of a breakthrough in terms of sales just because of people get used to it. And
I think so. And as added benefit, I brought a top 10 list. This is where sites that already have the electronic gaming to show and give an indication of it is working. Not just, it's not in all sites. We get that. But there's a top 10. I don't know if there's somebody on a hand.
Yeah.
But briefly, Harry's Bar up in Hill City, Orky's Bar over in St. Paul, Roosevelt up in Eveleth. These are small locations, relatively speaking, but had monthly gross sales for January of over $80,000 in activity, all above our original projections on a per-site average. So there's some success stories. This is the kind of information that we work with the industry, the charitable gaming reps, the bars, to say we need to get the word out. Now, we're regulators. We're not the lottery in terms of we don't have a marketing budget. We're not the marketing agency. But it's those kinds of things, I think, to help get the word out, get that comfort level up, as well as continue to bring in additional vendors that have products that they want to make available. And one thing we haven't talked about is Link Bingo. That's another game, electronic game, that's coming down the pike. Would I have liked to have seen it in operation today? Yes. Unfortunately, the vendors are still working on their product development. Again, happy to come back
because
I know that's still a
topic. Yeah, that's a good brief synopsis, and we appreciate that.
Okay, thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. And so what? So what? How's your budget kind of shape up here then?
Mr. Chair, I mean, right now we're comfortable with where we're at.
Okay.
I know there was a concern when this new format came in. What is it going to mean? And we've been very frugal. We haven't launched and done a full staffing expecting at this point in time. We're waiting to see the numbers increase as well.
Okay.
The assurance I give you, because we are 100% dedicated funding from the industry we regulate, what we don't spend goes back to our bank account to be then reappropriated. So happy to share some of those details. But I know there's a concern in terms of what we appropriated based on some anticipated increase in the activity. But we're comfortable where we're at. I can tell you right now we probably won't spend, at least for the first year, what was laid out.
Appropriated, okay.
But there's still some unknowns. We're now working with IT in terms of the expectation was would we need to have a central computer system to monitor all the other systems that are coming in. And that's becoming more apparent that we're going to need to do that. The vendors have provided us with their model equipment, so we monitor their games, their activity, which I will take the opportunity. This new format has given us an opportunity we've never had before in terms of oversight daily, by the minute, for what's going on at sales locations. Under the old paper format, which is still out there and very popular, it's running roughly 7% ahead of where it was last year. We don't get that data, that information, for at least another 2 months after they report to revenue. So we have some access, and that's where the had a hearing yesterday just based on the activity for January. Very current, but we get to see what happens at those activities. We see any bar that's selling after hours. They won't. They can't. It's those kind of good things regulatory-wise that this is new format. Inventory control, another great thing. So I could go on, but
no, that's good. Thank you. Is there any questions for Mr. Barrett? I think you answered them, and we appreciate you coming to us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Yeah. Next, we have lottery, the Minnesota Lottery. Mr. Van Petten and Mr. Feeney. And we have some electronics here.
We do.
Yeah. So if you gentlemen would for the record would identify yourselves and go for it.
Hi, Mr. Chair. My name is Ed Van Petten. I'm executive director of the Minnesota State Lottery. With me is Don Feeney, director of research and planning, and he plans everything besides marketing our products, as you can see. And before I get started, based on my experience with other committees, I don't have an accent. It's everybody else. But as such, I am new in Minnesota, and I've been appearing in the Kansas legislature for about 25 years. So if I lapse in protocol, please call me on it, and I will learn. So things are pretty similar, but slightly different. And we know that some of you are very familiar with the workings of the lotteries and some not so much, so we will try to present enough information to perhaps educate, but not so much that we try to bore those of you who are more familiar. And I would point out that about the only thing you really see on your spreadsheets in the course of the year is the money we bring in. As you'll see, the governor recommends a cap on our spending, and the legislature agrees with that. This year, the governor's office neglected to include that in the recommendations. However, we have met with the budget analysts, and we have agreed on a recommendation, which we will point out further into the information. We are not structured like other state agencies. The legislature approved the voters approved the lottery in 1988. Legislature developed the enabling legislation in 89, and the lottery began selling in 1990. My position is appointed by the governor, and with advice and consent of the Senate, and I'm presently within the confirmation process. And I serve at the will and pleasure of the governor. And as stated, the governor and the legislature approve our budget, and we are audited annually by an outside firm and periodically by legislative audit. Presently, we have 147 staff members. That is down from over 200 staff about 10 years ago. We have four regional offices, as you'll see, and I would encourage any members of the committee who wish, or the committee as a whole, or division in this case, to visit the offices at any time and see more about our operations. You also see our net proceeds, which is equivalent probably to net profit in the private sector, is divided 60% to the general fund, 40% to the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and that is a constitutional mandate through the year 2024. The in lieu of sales tax is appropriated by statute and is modifiable by the legislature, 28% of that to the general fund, 36% game and fish, and 36% to the Natural Resources Fund. Obviously, any of those appropriations other than the trust fund could be modified. Contributions which go to the state include unclaimed prizes, and that is a fairly substantial amount annually, and we also do the revenue recapture, which is money owed to the state or other municipalities, and when a winner comes in to make a claim, we do check that with every major claim. Last year, income tax withholding amounted to $12.3 million. So as you can see, when we have a big jackpot winner, it helps everybody. Lottery sales last year for fiscal year 12 started out as of September 1, over $30 million behind the year before. We, as you know, the state government was in a shutdown for about 3 weeks. And then we had to get product back out in the field as well as get players acclimated to playing again. However, the year was ended with record sales of over $520 million. And I came March 1, so I can't take any credit for that one, but staff did an excellent job. At this time, we're sitting at about $328.6 million in sales as of this week's tie-off. And so that is on pace for another record year, and that would be 6 years in a row of record sales. More importantly to this division, we also transferred a record amount of money last year to the state, a total of approximately $124 million. And that shows that profits are up about 57% over the last 10 years. Here you'll see the revenue distribution based on total sales of $520 million. As you can see, prizes are our largest expense, obviously. And retailers earn about 5.5% for sales, 1% for cashing. Last year, the average retailer earned about $10,100. Here you see the distribution to the beneficiaries, and this is the proceeds to the state, which includes the in lieu of sales tax, net proceeds, and unclaimed prizes. You'll see that approximately $55 million total goes to the environment in Minnesota. Summary of performance over the last 10 years shows sales up 68%, revenue to the state up 57%, operating costs and staffing decreasing. And operating expenses by category, and this is how they're broken out. If you want more detail, I'd be more than happy to provide that. But as you'll see, we are operating under the recommended spending caps. The operating caps we are requesting for the next biennial budget is $30.5 million per year. And as you saw from the previous slide, that is slightly above where we anticipate coming in, but it does give a little cushion. Governor's made two recommendations that could affect our budget, the first being sales tax on business services. We estimate that that could increase our expenses during the course of the year about $500,000, mostly from advertising and audits. And there's also a proposal for a benefit game to fund veterans programs. We certainly can do that. In fact, when I was serving with the lottery in Kansas, we did that for, I think, 8 years of my tenure. The one thing you want to keep in mind is it will not generate additional income or additional revenue. The retailers have, you know, so many spaces in which to sell lottery tickets, so if we put the veterans benefit game in, it's going to take another game out. What we saw was the first year or two, a little bit of incremental gain, but you can't expect total incremental gain in that case. You will eat into other sales a little bit. That being said, if there are additional gambling bills, we are always willing to provide any expertise we can to assist the legislature. And that was a very brief overview. If the division would like additional information in the future, I'd be more than happy to come back. You can see our website. There's lots of additional information on our website. And as I said, you're welcome to visit anytime.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Petten, I'm noticing in this overview here talking about problem gambling. Where do people who have that go to get their course or go through the
well, we are somewhat Mr. Chair, yep. Senator. We are fortunate to have the president of the National Problem Gambling Council, National Council on Problem Gambling, there we go, sitting at the table. I'll just defer to Mr. Feeney for that, if that's okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, Don Feeney, Research and Planning Director of Minnesota State Lottery, and as Ed just mentioned, currently serving as President of the National Council on Problem Gambling and also on the state's Problem Gambling Council as well. Senator Anderson, the state, we are fortunate in having, I think, one of the better funded programs in the state for in the country for the treatment of problem gambling. There is a helpline that is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you call that and say that you have a problem, you will be referred to one of approximately somewhere between 50 and 60 different treatment programs that are located around the state. Those are operated through the Department of Human Services, funded through the Department of Human Services. That their appropriation will obviously not come through this committee. But the upshot of it is that in Minnesota, anyone with a gambling problem will be able to receive treatment regardless of ability to pay.
Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feeney, does that get charged back to you then, as far as if the Department of Health and Human Services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, up until the past year, all of the funding for the state gambling problem gambling program did come from the lottery. Last year, with the stadium bill, there was also a dedication of some of the pull tab funds to that program as well. Although I believe that because of administrative something or other, that money actually has not been received yet.
And Mr. Chair, last question, Mr. Feeney. Do you know the results as far as people going through this program, as far as their getting over this addiction, or have any type of statistics regarding that?
Mr. Feeney.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, statistics, no. I mean, I don't either here or nationally. There have been some attempts to study effectiveness of treatment, not only, both here and in other parts of the world. The conclusion that the researchers have come to is that it is that treatment is effective, although like any other chronic health problem, not always. You're always going to have people, for example, who don't take their diabetes medication. And likewise, you'll have people who do not follow through on their addiction treatments. What makes it difficult to measure is that for some people with gambling, as well as with substance abuse or a whole variety of chronic health conditions, there are people who need to go to treatment more than once before it kicks in, so that we know that the percentage of people who are not actively gambling either 6 months or a year after treatment is relatively high. I want to say that it's around 60%. We don't know what happens 10 years out. We don't know how many of those people had to go through treatment more than once.
Thank you.
Senators, thank you. Other questions for the gentleman? I think you did a pretty good job.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Last but not least is the Minnesota Historical Society.
Go on there. Working, huh?
Mr. Elliott, we appreciated you taking the time to bringing the committee over and showing us around the Historical Society. It's truly a beautiful building, and you do a terrific job. And understand your pride in saying you're the number one historical society in the United States. And I haven't seen a lot of others, but I got to believe you're probably pretty. You're pretty much on there. So we're looking forward to your presentation, and introduce everybody and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was indeed. My name is Stephen Elliott. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society, and I'm accompanied today by our chief financial officer, Peggy Ingeson, our director of public policy and community relations, David Kelleher, and in case we need to reach into the stands for help, our deputy directors for program and external relations, Pat Garter and Andrea Kier, are with us. May I say, sir, that was truly our pleasure. Thank you for having the committee visit. And for those who could not make it the other day, please know that we'd love to whirl you through and would be glad to provide an experience that would help to supplement today's presentation.
Anyway, what we need to do here for the tape is you need to officially, when you speak, officially introduce yourself to the tape.
Okay.
Before you start speaking, that's all.
So this is Stephen Elliott, and as I said a little earlier, I'm the director and CEO.
Okay, you already said that. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay.
So since some of the committee members had an opportunity to visit and get a glimpse of what we do, today I'd like to quickly make a few points about the work of our departments and divisions. So we'll walk through the handout that you have and then focus on the budget numbers. At its heart, the Minnesota Historical Society is an educational organization dedicated to learning about our state's past. We serve learners of all ages. One of the important things to know about MHS is that while we're older than the state itself, we have had a very long and productive partnership with the state. While not a state agency, we're a 501c3 with an independent governing board, our relationship provides flexibility, the opportunity for much operating efficiency, and the ability to bring in additional revenue fundraising. We are constantly examining what we do and how we do it in order to serve the public in the best way that we can, as efficiently as possible with the resources we have to work with. And to that end, about less than 2 years ago, we began to take stock of our situation, look at our strengths and the needs of the state and Minnesotans, and developed a strategic plan. The plan was adopted by our board in June of last year, but the plan is an ongoing effort. In continuous quality improvement, one is planning, implementing, checking, looking for improvements, implementing the improvements, and just continuing to do that constantly. And we are also integrating the priorities in that strategic plan in all of our departmental and operation work plans and continuing evaluation. Our mission statement reflects our aspiration to use the power of history to transform lives. Our strategic priorities focus the work that our staff does to serve the people of Minnesota. I pause here briefly to mention two initiatives that have come out of the strategic planning efforts. First, evaluation. Our work to strengthen our evaluation efforts were inspired by work in the first round of legacy funding, where the expectation was that those dollars would be spent in a transparent and accountable manner. And so we worked with the Wilder Foundation, Minnesota's own experts on evaluation, to incorporate evaluation into all the work that we do. Secondly, we strive for continuous improvement in all the work the staff does, and we have begun to work with the Department of Administration's LEAN program, L-E-A-N, so that that process is incorporated in the work of the society. We've had the LEAN team in for training. We have more training scheduled, and a few examples, early examples of the incorporation of this in our work is in the reference area and in looking at the process for digitizing material. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you have a lot of demands on the budget for which you're responsible, so let's just think for a minute about why history matters. Well, the work of the Historical Society provides, we provide educational experiences for all Minnesotans, young and old, and our work reaches statewide. Secondly, we perform some core functions of state government. We're actually charged to perform these functions of preservation and providing access to evidence of the past, to work on historic preservation, and to manage the state's historic sites network, and to work with the state ed department on providing a good, solid history education for Minnesotan students. We're an integral part of the tourism economy, and a very important part. Cultural tourists are some of the best tourists there are. They tend to come, linger, and spend more. And finally, we're the state's stewards of so much of Minnesota's tangible history, all of those many types of records, things, museum objects, buildings, and we work with others to ensure that this legacy is passed on to future generations. So we are an organization with a diverse set of activities outlined here, and we perform for the state a number of functions that in some other states are performed by separate state agencies. But in the Minnesota model, which is, I think, the best in the country, there are a number of functions that are combined under one umbrella, which enables collects in one place and enables that staff to work together very synergistically.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the director. That last slide, you talked about education for all Minnesotans, young and old. How close do you work with the Department of Education?
Mr. Elliott.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, we work very closely with the Department of Education on a number of things. For example, the curriculum for elementary students on Minnesota We work with the State Ed Department on developing that curriculum and the educational goals and standards. We actually publish the textbook and develop the additional online resources. We mount teacher workshops and training for that and provide other supplemental learning material and experiences. That's one example, but we work with the state and other state ed department in other areas as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. So, Director, what happens if all of a sudden the curriculum changes from the state of Minnesota to negate some of our historical past as far as being taught to the students? How do you play a role in because you're talking about history here, if some of that gets negated out of the social study or the history curriculum that's being taught at the schools, how much influence do you have on the commissioner or those that are in charge of that curriculum?
Mr. Elliott.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I think the part of that that would pertain most to us would be the will become the sixth grade curriculum about Minnesota, because that's where we play a more central role. And we have not seen anything that looks to us like a degradation in that Minnesota curriculum. As a matter of fact, where in the past it's been required that Minnesota be taught somewhere within a band of grades, which means sometimes it doesn't get addressed very well, going forward, Minnesota will be taught in the sixth grade. That more specific assignment will help to ensure that it really is present in the instructional curriculum during the course of the year. But there is a challenge with that, which I was going to allude to a little later in my presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Gott.
Okay. The functions that we perform, I think we looked at on the last slide. This is how we're organized to do our work. The chart on the screen is kind of hard to read, but I think that chart does show up well on your handout. So while we have a broad and diverse set of activities, I'd like to just take a moment to mention our statewide presence through the state's Historic Sites Network. Our motto for these sites is History Where It Happened. These sites add to our local economies, help to tell the important stories of Minnesota's past. Of course, Mr. Chair, you're very familiar with the local interest that develops with the historic site. Forest History Center is right there in Grand Rapids. The next several slides give a sense of the scale of our activities. I won't read each of these items, but I think this does give a sense of the scale and diversity and richness and depth of the collections that we hold on behalf of the people of Minnesota. It's truly an exceptional collection of material. And important to this is providing access. We serve nearly 1 million people with in-person visits at historic sites and museums, nearly 250,000 school children. And, Mr. Chair, one of the activities that we are proud of is the Northern Lights sixth grade history curriculum. Senator Anderson has a copy of the last version, last edition of Northern Lights, which is now being revised. New print edition will be out in June with supplementary online material.
Mr. Elliott, I don't expect you necessarily to know this, but have we come full circle? Because I remember it must have been in 61 when I was in sixth grade, we were taught Minnesota history, and we had a book, and so have we gotten around there? But everybody in the school district was required in sixth grade to be taught Minnesota history. Is that the way it's always been, or is that something that's changed and now it's coming back to sixth grade?
Mr. Chair, it hasn't always been that way, and that could have been a decision made by your school district to say that within that required band of grades in your district, they would do it in sixth grade. Because it's been a local option as to where it would happen.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. In addition to the sixth grade work, the other part of the K through 12 experience where we have a good touch is at the secondary level, where we mount across the state a program called History Day. It is a tiered history project competition. It goes from the local school, local district and regional competitions, a wonderful state competition that's held in the basketball arena at the university. And then we send about 60 Minnesota youth to the Nationals, and every year they bring home the lion's share of medals from the Nationals competition. We operate the largest and, by all accounts, best state history project competition in the country. And our Minnesota students do us proud. I'd also like to mention some
Mr.
of
Elliott,
the...
what was the winning winning project or the highest-ranked project from last year?
What was the one that she did? Oh.
Or give me an example of a couple of them. You don't have to give me the project. I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, what a project would be like.
And one, in some cases, these youngsters go out and create their own and find their own sources. So two history, memorable National History Day projects, I remember, were one had to do with the integration in Little Rock, where some students actually interviewed those now senior citizens, but sure. Kids who were students who had to walk through, endure the taunts and the threats, and integrate Little Rock High School. In another case, I recall a project where a student found Frances Gary Powers' widow and interviewed her about that. Some of the work these students do are amazing, and they select the medium in which they want to present okay. the research that they did.
Good. Thank you for thanks.
Yes, sir.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, this book here, The Northern Lights, is those copies available to purchase at the History Center?
I believe so. They're in the store there on the first level. Yes.
Do you know? Yeah, that would be okay. Great. Love to get one.
Good. I'll just mention some of the other people that make our work possible. We are supported by 24,400 members around the state and nearly 2,300 volunteers. We couldn't do what we do without those volunteers, bless their hearts. In short, you have in front of you a quote from Elmer Governor Anderson, who was a great friend of the society. And I think it sums up the importance of the work that we do with your important support. Mr. Chair, now we will begin to look at budget numbers. This slide provides a sense of our overall budget picture. Overall, state funding comprises about two-thirds of our budget, with state general fund dollars making up the single largest share. The state's funding is absolutely vital. Most recently, the state provided a little over $20 million each year for the society's operations. It is important to note that this funding provides a foundation for all that we do. We are able to raise additional funding to provide a high-quality statewide history program. And our donors tell us that they are willing to help out in partnership with the state. We leverage your contribution. Our work is people-intensive. It takes staff to acquire collections, to handle them, to make them accessible, to greet and teach our visitors at the Historic Center and our historic sites. Not surprisingly for our work, about 60% of our state general fund budget is spent on people. And a great deal of the balance, actually half, is spent on fixed cost of operating facilities, utilities, maintenance, et cetera. This slide presents another way of looking at how our funding is spent by program area. And you can see that the History Center, the green piece, and the historic sites, the blue slice, comprise about half of our overall budget. This slide provides a sense of where we've been over the last 10 years. Since 2003, our state general fund budget has been reduced by about 25%. So we're working now with about $7 million less in annual appropriation than we had at that point. But I have to commend the staff. The staff has worked very hard to become as lean as possible internally and to maintain services as much as possible for the public.
Mr. Elliott, if with that $7 million, I'm sure there's efficiencies, I'm sure there's many things you can do, but if there's one thing that that we've seen decrease or something we don't have that we had that many years ago, what would that be?
Would you allow me four?
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, these are the things that we would most like to be able to do that we can't do now. First, our historic sites network. We have had to contract our seasons in the shoulder seasons and our hourly schedules. We have fewer staff for people to meet when they come. The program is refreshed less frequently. But most importantly, with our historic sites network, we would like to be able just to open up some of them a little more. For example, Forest History Center, we'd like to be able to, at least on Saturdays in September. Not in this step, but somewhere down the road, we'd like it to be open 6 days a week in the summer. That's the sort of thing we'd like to be able to do at some sites. Secondly, the research library. The research library is a very important portal for folks. And right now, the research, we've jiggered with those hours to best meet how people are actually using the library and what our users tell us. But it's not open on Sundays. And we would really like for that library to be able to be open every day the History Center is open. And for people who travel some ways to use the library, that would be a great convenience. So that would be a second area. And related to the library and the collections that it represents, I'm actually sad to tell you this because I think it's shocking, but in terms of collections, where we once had three curators handling the museum collection, we now just have one, and that person is so busy taking care of the collection, fielding requests, doing the work of what used to be three people, that we cannot pay attention to acquiring material like we used to do. And where 10 years ago we would acquire 3,500 new museum items in a year, we now acquire more like 32. And that's core preservation and collecting that we would like to replenish. And so if that was three, then the fourth actually goes right back to Northern Lights. Because with the change from banding 4 to 6 to requiring that Minnesota be taught in the sixth grade, that means that there are some teachers who will now be required to teach this that haven't taught it before because it was in fourth grade or fifth grade. And right now there's no money to provide the teacher training and workshops to train those sixth grade teachers. So those are... We would not make a case to kind of pull that money back, but we would dearly love to have, and you have requests for two pots of $500,000 each. Those are the sorts of things that are represented in those pots.
Okay. Good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So for this session, the governor's recommended level funding of approximately $20.4 million for MHS activities, not including the pass-through appropriations. Should additional funding be provided, we'd be able to increase access to the state facilities in which the state's really made significant investments and which our Minnesotans, they love to enjoy. So this would include broadening some of the hours and seasons of the historic sites, the library, increased access to and care for collections, improved field services and statewide outreach local organizations. And in the second initiative, to improve educational achievement, we'd be enhancing teacher training and development of curriculum material to accompany the Northern Lights curriculum.
We have a question from Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You may not have the budget book, but in 2012 and 13, it looks like, It looks like there was a significant reduction in the appropriation, not so much in the general fund, but in other state funds. Went from 57.9 million to 31, a little over 31 million. What was the result of that? I mean, where did that reduction come in?
Mr. Chair, if I may ask Ms. Ingerson to respond.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, that's primarily the legacy funds that we receive, because in the legislation, the legacy funds are considered one-time funds, and the governor hasn't made a recommendation for the legacy funds. But that's primarily the difference between the 57 and the 31.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ingerson, that appropriation you're expecting will come during this session?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And Ms. Ingerson, will you identify yourself for the...
Oh, yes. Sorry. Peggy Ingerson, Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Historical Society.
We're glad to have
Thanks.
You here. Yeah.
Thanks.
Mr. Elliott.
Yes, sir. Thank you. So the slide we have up now breaks down the budget by program, and you'll notice that the main program for MHS is called Programs and Operations. We show historic preservation tax credit, grant in lieu of credit. Also, this is a program that was passed by the legislature in 2010. It's a statutory appropriation, an open and standing appropriation. It appears on the tracking sheet but not in the appropriations bill. And we also serve as a fiscal agent for a number of entities and projects. And the next slide breaks down the overall budget by funding source. The general fund is sometimes called our direct appropriation, also shows the historic preservation tax credit and grant in credit. So if I may, just in closing, say that I think that what we would love to leave with you are these points, that from the time of the territorial legislature, Minnesota has been exceptional in taking care of its history, in tending to its documentation, to collecting it, to making it accessible and meaningful for people. And I think the society today stands well in that tradition, and I think the work that we do in our educational programming is actually a model for many others. Secondly,
before you go on from that last slide, I'm looking down on expenditures 12-13. It's 713 million. And then there's 79 and 14-15. I mean, explain to me what the difference in those totals. And
Mr. Chair, may I ask Mrs. Ingerson to respond?
Sure. Mr. Chair, again, Peggy Ingerson responding to this question. What is shown in the document here is all of our funding. So we've kind of delineated and broken out the state general funds, the legacy funds, and then what are non-state funds. The documents in the budget document show all of the non-state funds as other state funds. So the $113 million is about 2 years encompassing all funds.
So you indeed, in 14-15, if you have a good project with the state legacy fund.
Right.
That
could
be.
Mr. Chair, we submit on behalf of the History Coalition a request for legacy funding for all of the partners that have received funding, and assume that would be presented to the Legacy Subcommittee in the Senate.
Okay.
And that's our expectation, that we have a request that actually exceeds that current amount.
Good. All right. Very good. Senator Stuff, did you have...
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just kind of off the top of my head, how many projects would occur where there are multi-state projects?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Elliott.
Oh, my gosh. Did you say multi-agency, multi-state?
No, multi-state, where, between, let's say, Minnesota and North Dakota.
Mm. Oh.
I can think of one or two right now. And the reason I bring it up is that, interestingly enough, both of them are bridges.
Both of them are what?
Bridges.
Bridges.
And in one instance, the other state used federal money, and that triggered a much higher cost in the restoration of that bridge. And in the other instance, there wasn't any. Just the opposite occurred. And I'm thinking that I wonder how many projects, you know, like we have with Wisconsin or Iowa or maybe even Canada.
I'm trying to think of programs that we have that are actually joint with other states. I can think of some that are joint with federal or where we're part of national or multi-state programs. May I ask Mr. Chair, our Deputy Director for Programs or Director of Public
Absolutely.
Policy to chip in?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pat Garter. I'm the Deputy Director for Programs at the Minnesota Historical Society. This isn't a complete answer to your question, but to just give you some additional information, we do some digitization projects. We're supporting the work of Iowa, North, South Dakota in particular, and that would be another place where we would be going after federal funding that would support that activity. So that's a specific, it's a partnership, but the Minnesota Historical Society has become a leader in the digitization projects, and so we are essentially being asked to assist other states in this activity, and then we go and get funding, or they go and get funding and pass it back to us so that we're able to assist them in the work that they are doing.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Garter, since you're there, you brought up something interesting because I have my children, when they were growing up, fell in love with Little House on the Prairie. And because there's many sites, one in Wisconsin, one in Iowa, one in South Dakota, do you interact with those states and the historical tying those that whole thing, that story together at all?
Senator, Ms. Chair, Garrett. Members of the committee, not in those specific instances. Those tend to be locally owned, managed, operated. So in the sense that we historically provide what we call field services, which are professional, consultative, supportive services to any historical organization inside the state of Minnesota. I couldn't tell you specifically and say, yes, we've worked with the Laura Ingalls Wilder House in southern Minnesota. We may have. I'm just not certain. But we do in our interpretive programming essentially limit ourselves to Minnesota. That is our charge. So there might be some regional overlap as we tell certain historical stories like the fur trade, which, of course, has a regional reach. But direct services like that outside of the borders of the state would be very limited.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Director or Ms. Ingerson or any of your staff there, do we interact with other agencies in the state of Minnesota, like just the Department of Education? And is there any type of where money can flow back and forth from the agency to your agency in regards to, like, the Northern Lights as an education tool that they could, you know, participate? Or I'm just – I don't know if there's any interagency type situations that go on there to supplement your budget or help you in a certain area of the Historical Society.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I'm David Kelleher, Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Historical Society. The first example that comes to mind is we have a cooperative agreement with the Department of Natural Resources where we assist them with archaeology. You might imagine the DNR does a lot of outdoors work with parks and trails, public waters and whatnot. The archaeologists who work with the DNR are actually our staff, and they contract out to the DNR and perform those research services. That brings money into our budget and helps the DNR with some experts out in the field to achieve their work. So we spend a lot of time with other state agencies sharing our expertise with them. Sometimes it involves money. Sometimes it doesn't involve money. Mr. Kerr from Military Affairs was here a little while ago. We've worked with his department on preservation of the flags that you see out in the rotunda. You might have seen in the paper a couple of weeks ago, they found some moon rocks in their basement. They didn't really know they were there, and they figured these items need a good home, and they transferred those items to the Minnesota Historical Society, where they're safe and out on display periodically. So we cooperatively work with various agencies.
Mr. Chair, in regards to that, so if you have big exhibits that are like the Civil War coming exhibit like that, you would work with Veterans Affairs or other people that could give you information, and they might have items that they could, you know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, yes. In fact, on the sort of publicity side, when the Minnesota's Greatest Generation exhibit opened up a couple of years ago, we worked very closely with Veterans Affairs to make sure that people were aware that that exhibit was there and that, that their constituency group was being honored in that exhibit. So we work pretty closely with groups like that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. So we're getting close to the end here. Is any other questions from the committee? If not, the one thing I'm looking forward to, it's March 2nd that the Civil War exhibit opens up, and that sounds like it's going to be a great thing to see. So, and we'll look forward to talking with you later too. And thanks for all the information that you gave us today.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
And
as for our committee, we'll continue budget work next Tuesday. We've got about six jurisdictions that we've done, so we've got quite a number to go. Tuesday we'll have the Architectural and Accountancy Board and the Barber Examiners Board, and I'm sure Mitch will come up with a couple more or two that we'll be able to take care of. Any other business to come before us? Meeting adjourned.
Good.